Friday, June 18th, was one of those wildly varied days. Actually, I guess you should say it began at about 4 o'clock when Lucy took coffee up to the astronauts. But not for me. I was sleeping soundly. But at 8 o'clock, I was eagerly awake because I wanted to see and hear Governor Dewey. He had come down to talk to Lyndon the day before about the crime situation in the District of Columbia. Lyndon is determined to enlist all the can-do men he can find, from Republicans as well as Democrats, intellectuals as well as teachers' college boys, to help him attack the problems he faces.
Governor Dewey
walked right into a whirlwind of activity, moving his way along in the tempest of the evening before, rather placidly, and I think enjoying himself hugely. He looked not a day older than in the political pictures I remember. Short, quick, terrifically bright, slightly tart, little black mustache. I found him very likable. He had breakfast on a tray with us in the bedroom. Lyndon was saying, "I want to do something yesterday to arrest this evil that is threatening the country. I am excited and frightened at the status quo. The district is right under our nose. We have got to set an example." I wished I could remember everything they said, because they were very interesting interplay. Dewey was saying, "If the policemen cannot question them, you will have practically no convictions." There's something about the questioning by policemen of people they arrest not being acceptable as evidence, and I don't begin to understand. He said, "The courts are living in an ivory tower." I got the impression he took a dim view of the way criminals were let out after serving a minor portion of their sentence. Lyndon was hammering away at the District of Columbia, reciting what had happened to the McNamara's daughter. He said, "I want to take the District of Columbia as a model. Murder will not wait." I gathered, too, that Tom Dewey thought that sentences imposed by courts these days were unduly light and easily upset by technicalities. Finally, as he started to leave, they got on the subject of personalities, and Lyndon said something very complimentary about Lucius Clay, whom he'd known and liked so much. He was Sam Rayburn's great friend over a period of the last 20 years. "And wouldn't he be just the right man for such and such a job?" Dewey laughingly replied, "Ah, Mr. President, you've just got to leave us somebody. He's just accepted the job as money raiser for the Republican Party." Sure enough, later in the day, I saw that headline, "New Treasurer." I gathered they hit it off rather well, Lyndon and Dewey. At any rate, he'd seen a lot of business transacted. What I think he had expected to be a 30-minute or at most an hour conference, and it had turned into about a 15-hour one, including a very short night spent in the Lincoln bedroom, the last remaining place to put a house guest. Next, I had a talk with Simone about the completion of the ABC filming, the days they would require, the sort of message we wanted to extract from it. That would be largely the job of the script, the wind-up, the peroration. And then I went to sleep. Right in the middle of the day, a long, self-indulgent nap. Then woke up to have my favorite lunch about 2:30 of scrambled eggs and worked on the mail. Had an interview with Meg Greenfield on the Truman balcony. Talked to Linda Bird about the news from Arizona about becoming a member of an Apache tribe at a barbecue for some 2,000 or so. Lucy's new car had arrived, a green Stingray. Combination graduation and birthday present. Lyndon is the sort of man who absolutely cannot keep from opening a gift that someone has presented him, nor can he wait until the exact birthday to give his little daughter her present. He asked me to call her out. He had the car driven up to the southwest entrance. Lucy came out, and she looked at it, and she squealed, and she ran, and she hugged him. The look in her eyes was just like when she was about 4 years old. Lyndon had brought a big box home from a trip down into Virginia, had set it on the living room floor of 4921 30th Place. Said, "Come over, Lucy, and open it up." She looked down, and there she saw a little beagle, aged 6 weeks. When she raised her eyes to her daddy's face, not all the angels in heaven ever had a sweeter expression, or one more full of joy. We were going to Camp David, and I'd spent part of the afternoon calling the guests. Trudy and Joe Fowler, Orville and Jane Freeman, the Busbys, the Attorney General and Lydia Katzenbach, Marianne Means, and Emmett Ryden. Lyndon had a lot of trouble getting loose from the office, so that there was a long wait between the time the guests began to assemble and the helicopter left Camp David. I, at least, with a holiday spirit, ready for a weekend of bowling and swimming and movies and good talk with a group I particularly liked. We had not been with the Katzenbachs much, or the Freemans, and I'm especially fond of Jane Freeman. I want to get to know all the cabinet people better. I feel we've known the Fowlers a long time. Tomorrow, the Vances are coming up, along with the Bill Moyers and the Goodwins. I had time to get a preview of the dress Lucy was going to wear, the party for the 250 diplomatic young people that evening. White organza, the capelet that looked sort of like angel wings. She was going to wear hair piled high with an old-fashioned curl falling down below her right ear, and a pink rose tucked into her hair. Camp David is always, for me, the greatest rest of all. I feel a lack of responsibility there, even if I am, in a way, the hostess. The log cabins, the rural setting, make it evident that everything's going to be informal. So I just drop my responsibilities off as I enter the woods, leading to Aspen, the big lodge. I had Joe Fowler on my right and the Attorney General on my left. It was an evening of good talk and a movie for everyone that could stay up late enough. Alas, I was not among them. My appetite for sleep is somehow overwhelming.